Welcome back to WAMC in a special edition of our roundtable time, which is taking a real hard look at what happened overnight as the House of Representatives voted to claw back money for public broadcasting. That's NPR, that is PBS, and this bill that was already passed in the Senate now goes to the president's desk, where it awaits his signature, which I assume will come pretty rapidly. We are, I am joined in the studio by Sarah Gilbert, our CEO and president of WAMC, WAMC's news director, Ian Pickus, roundtable producer, and our Sarah LaDuke is here, and we welcome you to join us. 1-800-323-9262 as we look to fill the gap and to make up for money that is being lost, essential money to keep WAMC and to keep public broadcasting alive. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dick Toefel to our program. Dick was the general manager of ProPublica from its founding in 2007 until 2012 and served as president from 2013 to 2021. And Dick, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here.
Joe, thank you for having me.
I have to say, you are, as I look at what you have written this morning about this situation, and I think we are, you know, we're all coming to terms with this, and I love when someone gives it to us straight. And you have a newsletter, and in that newsletter, in the Substack newsletter, it begins with these words: "It's even worse than it looks." Well, there you go. Give us a sense of how it's even worse than it looks.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be the person to tell you that, or one of the people to tell you that. It's worse than it looks in a couple of ways. This will have particularly dramatic effects, as I think people have been saying, on rural communities. The more rural, the worse in general across the country that it's going to be, because those stations are the ones that have been most dependent on federal subsidy. But when we get past that, some of those stations are going to fail. I know of multiple stations across the country that have told people internally and to some extent externally that if this happened, they will fail. And I think by the end of the year, we'll start to see those failures. Those stations have been supporting the national programming that everyone in the country has been able to enjoy. Their contributions to it will therefore disappear. That will put more pressure on the remaining stations to pay more for what is, of course, even at the national level, going to be less. And so you have the threat of a real downward spiral. That's one thing. And the second reason that I think is clearly foreseeable that it's going to be worse is when you lose those rural stations. One of the things that you've had both on radio and television in public media is the ability to say to sponsors, what I would call more colloquially advertisers, that you can buy public media on a national basis. If you're missing a lot of rural communities around the country, you're going to lose that revenue as well, because a national advertiser is going to say, well, there's a lot of other national options, and these people have huge holes in their map. So those are the two things that I think people are not focusing on, as well as the really significant problems that they are already focusing on.
How do you believe that it impacts the average listener as far as getting information, independent, factual information, to make the decisions that are vital to a democracy?
Well, you know, I mean, look, I'm looking at right now the home screen of your website. And you've got stories published in the last... No. And here's
okay,
the answer, right?
Ahead.
You've got stories published in the last day on zoning issues in the town of Lloyd and on a proposed merger between Russell Sage and the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Science. Those stories aren't available in a lot of other places. If if local public radio is under real threat, those stories are going to be accessible to either nobody or certainly to a lot fewer people. So at the local level, that's the single biggest problem. And then you have that the quality of the national content, the All Things Considered, the Morning Edition, that kind of stuff is going to get eroded as there's less contribution to it.
1-800-323-9262. You hear the phones ringing. We want to keep them ringing. 1-800-323-9262.
Hello, Dick. It's Sarah. It's nice of you to join us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
I wonder whether or not you might put this in a broader picture of the media landscape for us. We've been talking here this morning about the fact that it's a moment when public media that's free to everyone really needs to stand up and survive. Ooh, have you gone?
And I can hear you.
Oh, you're waiting for me to ask you an actual question. Let's do that then.
Yes,
so,
sorry.
So, you know, talk a little bit, if you would, about what is going on in the broader media landscape, the ways in which big media organizations are dealing with, you know, various incoming threats from a White House, which is clearly interested in a much more controlling relationship with media organizations than they used to be. Public media is obviously accountable to nobody but the public. That's important right now, isn't it?
It's especially important. I mean, first of all, you have the business problems of the for-profit press, which is almost all of the nation's metro newspapers are now in the hands of hedge funds, which are in the process of winding down their operations. In Albany, you happen to be fortunate, actually, to be in the hands of Hearst. But around the state more broadly, this is a very serious problem. And then you have a government that seems determined to look for a sort of Soviet era press that is simply mouthing its preferred version of the world. And when they don't find that, enormous pressure brought to bear on owners and other points that they see a vulnerability to bring people in the line. You had CBS, for instance, just in the last week or so, pay money to the president personally, millions of dollars, to settle a lawsuit that everyone in the legal business and even CBS had insisted correctly had no merit at all. So that's essentially a bribe personally to get a merger through. That and last night, for reasons no one can understand, they canceled the Colbert Show, which is the number one rated show in its time slot. That doesn't happen. Number one rated network shows don't get canceled. This one did. Why? Probably because it's been critical of the president. So that's the media landscape that some people are trying to produce. And the question is, are people prepared to, in effect, vote with their feet another way?
Certainly a direct blow to journalism and trusted journalism. Ian.
Dick, it's Ian Pickus, the news director here, and thanks for looking at our homepage. We'll take the hit for sure. I just wonder, you know, can you put into perspective for us what you think might be the effects of these actions on a local level in terms of how local journalists go about their work? I don't know if you've seen it in your purview, but I know here in the Northeast, there are certain elected officials and public people that WAMC covers who are embracing a lack of access to reporters or outright bullying reporters or that kind of thing. Do you see a trickle down in how local news may operate right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, Ian, thank you. But I spend my weekends probably an average of about 3 days a week in your coverage area and the other 4 days in New York City. And actually, I see it in both places. There are fewer people bringing less accountability to all sorts of public activities. And that is really a problem. I mean, I find some public officials are frustrated because they can't get the word out about things that they want to. That's one problem. And other public officials, the ones you wish people were scrutinizing, are doing things that are really, really unfortunate because nobody's watching.
1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org to help us fill the gap this morning as we talk, as the legislation goes to the president's desk to claw back the money for public broadcasting, including NPR and PBS. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org.
Dick, stand by. I've got a couple of messages to read. We have a new member, Anonymous from Florence, Massachusetts. This one really got to me. This person says, I wanted to call but was afraid I would cry because I'm so angry and sad. I live alone and listen to the roundtable to keep me company at home. I have an extremely limited budget because I'm on Social Security and I've never donated before, but this matters too much. Thank you for existing. We're so lucky to have you. We are so lucky to have you, Anonymous, in Florence, Massachusetts. What a lovely, lovely message to get this morning. Thank you so much.
And it's a reminder of the importance the station has, not only for us, but for our listeners, those who have been with us for decades, those who have been with us for months and years, and for the overall community of the seven states that we serve. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC.
Hey, Dick, it's Ian again, and as we just heard that wonderful message, maybe a bit of optimism here, but here's an impossible question for you. What should we be doing to get through this moment? I mean, it seems like the message from on high is to cow journalists. Do you think we should respond in a different way?
So I think that, honestly, Ian, there's two things you should be doing. One is just to continue to do your job of reporting the news. It's worth spending a little time on this morning, and then I think, frankly, it's worth mostly getting back to work. To do what people count on you to do. If I can say a word to what your listeners can do, if people are in a position to and are inclined to give, I would personally urge them to give a recurring monthly gift. This is a problem that is now going to be a permanent problem. This is not a one-day thing. This money hasn't been taken away for a year. It's very likely been taken away permanently. Public media is going to need your sustaining support. And if you're in a position to do that, even for slightly less today, but doing it every month, I think makes a lot of sense. And in the long run, will help a lot.
As you were saying those words, everyone in this room all went, aw. We thank you so much for that and for helping us and get the message out and for the great information that you provide as well. Dick Toefel, former president of ProPublica, we thank you so much for being with us. It's been an absolute delight to have you on the program, and we're very proud to have you here and helping us this morning. Thank you.
Take care.
Be well. I'll go to the host of our Congressional Corner segment here on the roundtable to properly introduce our next guest.
Thanks, Joe. It's Ian Pickus here with Sarah Gilbert and Sarah LaDuc. And our guest, and I don't have my notes that I'd normally have in front of me, but let's see how well I do.
I think you know what he does.
Yeah, I think you know.
New York Congressman Paul Tonko, a Democrat from the 20th District, in office since 2009. Congressman Paul Tonko, thank you for being with us on this important day.
My pleasure, Ian. I'm currently traveling on train, but this is such an important topic and such a cruel outcome that I wanted to reach out to you folks. You know, I'm a big fan of PBS, and certainly it's a really cruel cut. As the Congress approved this $9 billion overall cut to already allocated funds, included in there is this $1.1 billion in total cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It is, think of the terrific programming for kids, for example. You know, teaching them not only ABCs, but teaching them kindness, teaching them respect. This is quality programming. And nearly 3 in 4 Americans, I'm reminded, rely on public radio for emergency updates, public safety alerts. So this affects a lot of people in a brutal way. So, you know, a terrible outcome that we're trying to avoid. Every attempt was made to exempt this effort, but they were determined, the Republican majority was determined in both houses to go forward with this cut.
Congressman Tomko, let me just ask you a simple question, which is how I would do it on the show, too. Why did you vote against the rescission package? I know you just outlined some objections to what it includes, but what about the process of the package coming from the administration?
Well, you know, this whole package, this rescission effort, is you're addressing a bipartisan, bicameral outcome that was approved a while back, and they made use of the Empowerment Control Act of 1974 to rescind $9 billion of what was approved funding, all based on a rubber stamping of Elon Musk's cuts that were offered on June 12th. So, you know, my concern with the Elon Musk approach is that they did not go in and talk to employees about the mission statement of the particular institution. In this case, you know, the Public Broadcasting Corporation. But they also didn't understand the mission statement in many ways, and or if that implementation of the mission statement was being done. You know, the whole effort for cutting into waste, fraud, and inefficiency really isn't the outcome they achieved here. They just cut out programs without fixing them, improving them, or the like, or perhaps in some cases, you know, could have sat down with employees to figure out the best outcome. Inspectors general from agencies that could have guided them, but they just came in pell-mell cutting. That wasn't addressing inefficiency or fraud. It just undid programming, which in this case is very critical programming. You know, I think as the Senate was addressing the measure, there was a need to have, you know, the public broadcasting reach out to folks in Alaska to alert them to a tsunami situation. So what you have here is a complete disregard for the quality program, programming, a complete disregard for the networking that two-thirds of Americans, or 3 in 4 Americans, say they rely on. So this is, I think, a very disassociated process with the people that are affected by these cuts. And it's just another example of a betrayal of the American public with the reconciliation bill that we did, and now this rescission act that was approved. Two-thirds of Americans, by the way, support federal funding for public radio, including well over half of Republicans. So go figure out who they were listening to here, other than just a desire to decrease government spending and not thinking of the consequences associated with their actions.
I have a two-part question for you, Congressman. And
sure.
One is, you've been on this program on our show for longer than any other congressman, and congratulations on keeping, you know, the job. Good for you. But it's fascinating to me, and I'm curious as to what you get out of it, in the sense of why it is important for you to come on our airwaves several times a year to talk to first Alan Chartok, now Ian Pickus, and to discuss these issues that are happening in our region, in our greater community, and give us a sense of what your job entails in Washington.
Well, I think quality representation begins with sound connection with people you serve, people who have placed their trust in you. And I can tell you, every time I'm on the station, the follow-up, the response from the public is at the greatest I get. I hear people saying, I heard you discussing various funding on the show. Thank you for informing us. People have a strong connection to the public broadcasting element. And I think that in this era of government, where this cutting frenzy is, grossly affecting people, it is important for them to know so they can get interacting into with the process, making certain that they have their voice heard, and enabling them to know the up-to-date information that is affecting them directly. And so I think this whole effort for public information and sharing with the general public what is happening, what the cuts proposed look like, can help avoid some of these situations. In this case, there was they were recalcitrant. They were not going to change a bit here, and they were going to rely on the efforts of Elon Musk, who I think has offered cuts without any sane process or any kind of incorporation of understanding the value added that comes with some of these services that they have now begun to deny.
Hello, Congressman. It's Sarah Gilbert here. I have a question for you. As you know from your many appearances and in interviews on this station, we do not shy away from asking tough questions. We put the tough questions to politicians of every stripe. We make sure that we get answers and start conversations and convene community members to tackle difficult questions. Can you just talk about, from your point of view, what happens if that disappears?
What happens with what now?
If that disappears, what happens if that goes away?
Well, I think, again, sound questions, again, the professionalism at these public stations,
on the train.
They're prepared to ask some of these tough questions, which is so important because facts ought to matter.
The Wi-Fi is usually so good. Go ahead.
There's no respect for science in many cases. And so I think part of the problem here was the overall reputation of public broadcasting, because they're known to drill deep into the issues. They're known to really put facts out there or challenge the various moves that are being made in government. That is important. That kind of interaction, that kind of stirring the pot, garners the public input, and it allows for sound discussion that can then tweak these legislative agendas and make certain that they're responding in science-based, evidence-based terms for impacts that can affect the great many of us. So I think the fact that you're very academic, that you don't just like bend the knee to an information and kind of serve as their opportunity to stir a message that is not always factually based is a threatening thing. And I think that, the reputation here is a very sound one for public broadcasting, because you do your homework, you ask the tough questions, and perhaps that was a thorn in the side here.
Congressman Paul Tonko, thank you very much for being with us. Always appreciate you being on our program and being on our side.
Well, let me just encourage everyone out there to support the fund drive. I know that 70% of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding goes directly to local stations. So this is a real hard hit for the local elements of public broadcasting. I will be contributing to the fund, and I encourage everyone to do so. I think it's so important that we keep this alive. The quality programming for many rural communities out there across the country, this is the best and only source, perhaps. And again, the programming for children is just quality. It's what we need. We need to nurture our children, and PBS does that in a way that not only teaches those ABCs, but advances kindness and respect. Great values that are hopefully the American values that we all cherish.
I have a feeling Paul from Amsterdam is not going to be a new member, but we appreciate it. Congressman Tonko, thank you. Thank you so much for being available for questions, for opening your town halls to the press, for telling the press when and where your town halls will be. I think these are fundamentals of a working democracy, and not everybody is doing it anymore. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. And thanks to the entire crew. You folks are quality, professional, and effective, and we need you out there. So good luck with the fun drive.
Get going. The cafe car closes in 5. Thank you very much. Congressman Paul Tsonko talking to us from a train, the choo-choo. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. WAMC.org. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. Michelle Martin is on the phone. I will let you properly introduce her, Sarah Gilbert.
Oh, my word. I'm so excited about this. I never thought I'd see the day, Michelle Martin, when I got to introduce you on a radio show. How are you?
How are we?
Yes.
How are any of us?
That's
how
the
about
question.
This? How about this? I'm better now that I'm talking to you. How about that?
Oh, that's nice. So let me just start. I obviously we've all been glued to the radio for the last few days listening to how all of this would turn out. I want to start by asking you about that tremendous interview with Ken Burns this morning. Wow.
Oh, well, thanks for that. Yeah, I was well, you know, it was one of those things, had to rely on the personal network, and because he's in the middle of a tour, he's promoting his latest film, which I'm super excited about, and I hope I didn't use up all my chits, because I would love to talk to him about the film. It's about the American Revolution, which, needless to say, is timed to the sort of anniversary of the nation's birth, or the... I hope I'm not hurting your feelings as a former Brit, am I, Sarah?
It's very hard to do, Michelle.
Sorry,
as
okay,
you know.
Well, I'm just making sure. Anyway, it's tied to the anniversary of the beginning of the American story, the American Revolution. It's a miniseries. It premieres in November, so we tracked him down in the midst of this, and he was nice enough to talk with us after a very long day. And I just think that he's a national treasure. I mean, he's a national treasure in helping us explain ourselves to ourselves. And I one of the things I think about the interview, and I hope people get a chance to listen to it if they didn't get to hear it this morning, is that, you know, public media was central to his career. He wouldn't be who he is without it. I mean, his first couple of films were things that no commercial entity would buy. I mean, who's doing a film about the Brooklyn Bridge? Mm-hmm. Who's doing a miniseries about, you know, the Civil War? Who's doing that? Well, there's no video, there's no, you know, who are you talking to? All the principals are no longer here. And he innovated a style for that people today call, like, I think they even have a name for it. They call it the Ken Burns effect, where he takes those stills. I mean, we can all see it in our minds. We can hear the music in our ears. I mean, we can hear it, where he takes these stills and somehow in interviews with knowledgeable people and this wonderful music, and makes things come to life. And he is just a master at this. And he talked about that, how pivotal public media was for him becoming who he is. And so I don't know what else to say. It's just really glad that we had a chance to talk to him. I guess I wish more people had listened to it and knew his story before. I don't know whether it would have made a difference, but here we are.
This is Ian Pickus. I'm the news director here at WAMC. I'm always looking for the local angle. I'll just add one quick thing about Ken Burns, which is that when Hampshire College was in danger of going out of business just a couple of years ago, Ken Burns was one of the famous graduates who helped rally some fundraising for Hampshire College at the time, where our Berkshire Bureau Chief Josh Landes went. And our coverage of that situation reminds me a lot of the moment we're in right now. You know, we have an option to keep it if we want to.
Well, the other thing I would say, too, I understand what you're saying about the local angle, but the other thing about Ken Burns is, this is the other point I'd like people to remember, is Ken Burns, he's from Brooklyn, New York, so shout out to Brooklyn, which is I'm from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
But his company has always been based in a small town in New Hampshire, and his work is really centered in communities like that one. I mean, he's not on the coast. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the coast. I mean, the 13 original states were where, but he's always spoken to the heart of America wherever it is. And by heart, I don't mean just the geographic center of the country. I don't mean that, but I mean the people who really make up the country. They're not the famous people necessarily. I mean, famous people, celebrities, you know, we all are interested in what they do. But he's interested in the rest of us. And that's who we're interested in. I know when I think about the stories that have really made my heart sing and the ones that really stick with me, they're not necessarily about the most famous people that everybody knows, but they're about the people who are, maybe we could call them, accidentally famous. They happen to be in the news because of some extraordinary experience that they've had, or that they happen to have touched some momentous moment, or they exemplify some important aspect of our lives in the moment. Those are the stories that stick with us, and those are the stories that we tell. Those are the stories that all of us here tell. And that's the other reason why I think this is so important. I mean, everybody's always going to interview people who are super famous, the guy or the girl who wins the medal, the gold medal, right? But what about the rest of us who really are the ones making history today? And those are the people that we are interested in. And those are the people we're dedicated to following and covering and walking with.
Before we leave the Ken Burns train completely, I just want to mention that he'll be appearing at the Palace Theater on September 10th, showing basically a preview of this, of the American Revolution, which will be on PBS on November 16th. Michelle, this is Joe Donahue at WAMC, and I just wanted to ask you personally, do you think of how this will affect your job, how it will affect the journalism that you do day in, day out?
You know, honestly, I haven't had time to think about that, but what I do think about are the people who I might not get to meet, because I don't get to meet them, because I don't have a way to get to them, or because I don't know that they're there. I mean, I started my career in local news, and local news, frankly, is the foundation of everything that we do. And a lot of the people who really stick with me, the people that I think about, are really the people that I met in the course of doing this work, because they touched a story that became important to all of us. Like, I'm thinking about, like right now, thinking about gosh, a woman that I met years ago when I was a very new, very young reporter, whose daughter had died in a terrible way. It was one of these terrible sort of stories that touches kind of everybody's life. And I talked to this woman off and on for years, and she became a spokesperson for what has come to be known as the victims' rights movement. You know, if a crime happens and the people who have been affected by the crime get to speak to the court, they get to speak to the court about how this event has touched them, that's called like a victims' rights advocate. That didn't used to exist. And that exists now because of people like this woman whom I met all these years ago after something terrible happened in her family. So those are the kinds of people that I think about. I think about a woman that I met in covering Hurricane Katrina, the 20th anniversary of which is coming up soon. And I remember meeting this woman when this incredible story in Houston, where I was based, I was reporting on the evacuees who were coming to Houston, you know, from New Orleans. Private citizens were taking people into their homes and giving them a place to stay. People saying, well, I have room. I have a room. And they would literally go to the arena where a lot of evacuees had gone, and they would present themselves to the people running the arena and say, I have 3 bedrooms. Who would you like to stay with me? And I met this one family member in Houston who had a big house that she wasn't using all of it. And she brought this entire family to stay with her until they could kind of get themselves sorted out. Those are the kinds of stories that we tell and that stick with us. The other thing that sticks with me is the fact that, you know, one of the things that irritates a lot of people about big news stories is when people kind of parachute into a community. You know, parachuting in has its place because, you know, parachuting in to a place is part of how we express to the rest of our country men and women that a story matters to them. It's not just about where it's happening. But the thing about a member station is they don't have to parachute in. They're in. They're already there. You know, they're already there. And these are the people that we rely on to help us tell these stories correctly in their totality and in all their nuance. So I guess the answer to your question, Joe, is I guess I'm not so much thinking about my job right now as I'm thinking about the people right now that I want to meet, whose stories I want to tell, and am I going to be able to tell them?
We remind our listeners that they can help us, 1-800-323-9262. So let's just broaden that out a little bit, Michelle. And let me ask you about the fine line between truth and bias, of when what we see as the truth is then interpreted as a bias.
What? Tell me, say more. Tell me more about what's on your mind.
Well, what's on my mind is that the reason that has been given over and over and over again from the administration is that National Public Radio and PBS is biased. Mm. We would look at it and say, okay, but we're telling the American people the truth, and we're telling them the facts of what is happening. Obviously, the great concern here is that you're silencing an entity that does indeed give you that facts, those facts. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on that, of what it is when we see us doing our job and that is seen by others as a bias.
Well, I would say that there is a sort of a conflict in this whole country right now that isn't just about public media, but about what expertise means. You know, we're not the only nonprofit that is being judged and in some cases attacked
right.
by people in power. And why is that? Is it because all these people are biased, or is it because they present a relationship to fact that is unwelcome or inconvenient for the people attacking them? I mean, I think that, look, everybody's got a lens that they look through the world through. It's so interesting to me that, you know, our CEO, Catherine Marr, was criticized for some tweets that she, or it's actually a TED talk that she gave before she became CEO of NPR when she was still with Wikipedia, where she talked about, are we in pursuit of truth? Are we in pursuit of knowable facts? And people criticize her for that. Like, how dare you say we're not in pursuit of truth? Well, truth can be almost a religious belief. I mean, truth can be something that speaks to a deep meaning or belief that you have that is apart from the facts. But what we are in, what I say we are in the business of knowable facts. We are in the business of presenting the best understanding of reality as we can apprehend it at this time. I think that's the business that we are in. And I think that I just ask people to, well, when, you know, it's almost like if somebody says something bad about somebody you know, my first question is, why are you telling me this? What's in it for you? What's in it for you? So I would ask people who are making these criticisms, like the people who are listening to these criticisms being made, I would ask, what's in it for you? Like, for some of these folks, it's competition. They just don't like the competition. It is a competition of ideas. So there's that. But it's also a question of who gets to decide what you think. We're not here, I say this all the time, and I've heard other colleagues say this, we're not here to tell you what to think. We're here to tell you what to think about.
Mm.
What to think about. And we are in the business of knowable facts. We don't get up in the morning saying, how can I get you to believe what I believe? We get up in the morning and say, what do I need to show you today? And I just think that that is a different service. The other thing that I find interesting is that a lot of the people who are very vocal critics of the work that we do don't actually do this work. Some of these are opinion folks who use the same means of communication that we use. They use television, they use radio, they use podcasts, etc. But they're not going to school board meetings. They're not going to city council meetings. They're not going to county council meetings. They're not going to hearings on transportation systems. They're not going to hearings unless they go with the purpose of already either disrupting it or telling you what you should do. We are going there with the purpose of telling you what they're talking about. So I just think some of the people who are most vociferous in these criticisms aren't even swimming in the same water. I mean, they might be swimming in the same water, but we're not swimming in the same destination. And frankly, I'm not sure where some of these people are getting their information or where they're going to get it from. Because a lot of these people, what they do is take the information we provide and then they make use of it, which is what a lot of these aggregators do, which is what some of these opinion broadcasters do. we are in the business of aggregating information. And I guess what I see is that many of the people who are in the business of finding things out are the ones under attack. And so I would ask people who are receiving this information to ask, what's in it for them?
Sarah Gilbert.
Michelle, I'm listening to you talk, and I'm thinking about a lot of the calls and the messages that we've had this morning. People who are really, really worried about us, you know, suddenly disappearing from the landscape as a network. Internally here, we've been having a conversation about the fact that, you know, we will do everything in our power to make sure that this station continues to serve its communities across the Northeast. I imagine you're having similar conversations at NPR about, you know, all hands on deck, because our service to the public matters more than anything.
Well, you know, absolutely. I mean, we have. Let me just say this, that we do continue to cover things other than this, other than ourselves. I mean, one of the things that we've been most interested in the last couple of days is what else is in that bill. I mean, $1.1 billion is a huge amount to public broadcasting, but there's another $8 billion in that rescission bill that mainly went to foreign aid. And we're still trying to figure out exactly what's in it and what does that mean. What does that mean to people who were relying on that aid, people who were relying on food, medicine, you know, nutrition assistance and things of that sort. So I do want to say that in the midst of this, we are continuing to do all of our work. And frankly, I think you all would probably agree with me about this. It's a little uncomfortable to be covering yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not exactly what we got here to do. Like, sometimes when people say they want to interview me, I'm like, why? You know, I don't I didn't get into this business to talk about myself. I get in this business to talk about you. But I do have to say that it is a concern. The health of the network overall is of great concern, because the strength of this is that this is a free public service that seeks to cover the breadth of the country and much of the world, as much of the world as we can. And that is our pressing concern. How can we continue to offer this service, especially to parts of the country where there is not robust, independent media that exists for the purpose of, as I said, telling you what to think about, not telling you what to think. So I'm told that there have been a lot of expressions of support. I guess I have to be honest, I've been so busy kind of in the studio these last couple of days, like doing this part, I haven't heard as much of that. But our CEO, Catherine Marr, was also on the program this morning. And that's one of the things she conveyed, is that there have been a lot of these expressions of support in recent days, but also concern, you know, are we going to be there? And obviously, we're doing the best we can. You're doing the best you can.
Michelle Martin, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day and for doing what, yes, you're right, none of us like to do is talk about ourselves and what we do. But it's very nice of you to be here for the greater good and to help us get the point across. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your diligence and hard work. And we so appreciate you being with us.
Well, I so appreciate you. And I don't know, that Palace Theater event in September sounds pretty good. I don't know if you maybe have any extra tickets to hand out.
We can get you in.
We can get you in. Say. Yeah, we can okay. Figure that one out.
Okay. All right. All right. Hopefully we'll talk soon.
Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Mm-hmm. Speaking of people who stand up when times are tough and things need to be investigated and looked into, we welcome Marty Baron to the show. A longtime journalist and newspaper editor, he ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe before being named the executive editor of the Washington Post in 2013. His role in launching the investigation of the Catholic Church's cover-up of sexual abuse by clergy was portrayed in the Academy Award-winning movie Spotlight. He left Daily Journalism in early 21, and he is the author of an amazing book. If you have not read it, you must read it, especially now. Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Martin Baron to the roundtable on WAMC this morning. How are you?
I'm well. Good to be with you. I wish we were on a different occasion.
Yeah, us too. I don't know why this just popped into my head, but were you invited to the wedding?
I think my invitation must have been lost in the mail.
Just wondering.
Either that, or they feared that I would overshadow the other guests there.
Yeah, that's always a possibility.
Entirely.
What do you make of this? Looking from your perch, certainly as a longtime editor, of what this means of the work that all of us do in journalism, and specifically with public radio, and when we are told by the government that we're not going to help you anymore.
Yeah, well, it's part of a pattern, really, during this administration, really, to attack the media in every way possible, to undermine it, undermine its resources, debilitate it as much as possible. And there are a lot of other examples out there. This, unfortunately, is the latest example. It's something that a number of politicians have been trying to do for decades, but this is something that this administration is able to achieve, if you can call it an achievement. It's really unfortunate. I think we need public radio. It's a vital element of news. You know, it comes at a time where so many sources of local news have really been declining and disappearing. You know, they're about, if you just look at the statistics, they're like a third of local newspapers that have gone out of business over the last 20 years. And there are something like 200 counties in the country that have no locally based source of news. So it's really important to keep a vibrant local news ecosystem. And public radio has been an essential part of that.
When you talk about how essential it is and just journalism as a whole, and you know, we were talking about even Stephen Colbert, that show being canceled. I mean, what do you see the atmosphere right now? Because it seems really grim, and not to mention what happened with 60 Minutes and also with CBS, and you've certainly been a part of that when it comes to big money and big companies that get involved in doing the work of journalism.
Yeah, well, it is a grim time. There's clearly a hostile environment toward the press, toward the press, a free and independent press. That's what people are hostile toward. I think it's not just an attack on people's opinions; it's an attack on facts. Really, you have a president now who wants to be the sole owner of the truth. Basically, he doesn't want to allow people to know and think anything other than what he wants them to think and know. And so, that's where we are. But I refuse to be defeatist about all of this. I mean, I continue to remain optimistic. It's great that you're getting support. And I'll offer mine. I think that history tells us that we can get through this. I mean, the press has faced a lot of difficult periods in American history. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, the first edition of the first American newspaper was published in Boston in 1690, and the very next day, the governor and council of Massachusetts shut it down. And then, you know, John Adams, you know, in 1798, he signed the Sedition Act. It was one of the worst things that could happen. And then, you know, along came Woodrow Wilson, and he you had the Espionage Act, and then the next year, the Sedition Act. And those were so horrible that Teddy Roosevelt, one of his predecessors, came out and, he said that they were making it a crime to tell the truth. And he had to remind President Wilson that, as he put it, the people of the country were his fellow citizens, not his subjects. We've come through difficult periods. Nixon was one, of course, and we've come through it. And so I'm confident that we'll come through it again. It's really critical. I think the most important thing is that we get the support of the American public, who believes in an independent and free press. I mean, look, this is what the founders wanted. They wrote it. They wrote it as the First Amendment. And James Madison, who was the principal author of that, talked about the need for freely examining public characters and measures. And And of course, there are, you know, public characters are like our government officials and people who have influence in society, who have disproportionate power, measures of the policies that affect our daily lives. I would point out the word freely. But I also would draw special attention to the word examining. And that means that we're not stenographers. If you look up the word examining in the dictionary, you'll see what it means. It means to investigate and inspect and to test. And that's what we should be doing, and that's what the founders wanted. And I view it as the original assignment that was given to the press in this country. And I think that we have a duty to a duty to fulfill that assignment. And so it's a tough time. History tells us we'll get through it, but it's been hard, and it may well get harder. But it's important that all of us who practice journalism and all who believe in independent journalism support it and persist, really.
Marty, it's Ian Pickus, and thank you for being with us. We have so much admiration for you. I had a question, and I hope I have my details right, but I remember your story about being summoned to the White House in the first Trump term, along with Jeff Bezos, the Washington Post publisher. And I think it's fair to say that the president was trying to exert an amount of pressure on you, seeking some capitulation by the Washington Post. I wonder if you resisted that. It was not a fun dinner for you, as I recall you talking about. Do you see in the second Trump term that there are fewer figures who are willing to stand up the way that you and the Post did in the first term? Because it seems to me that there is a lot of capitulation happening now, and there's a lot of interest in kind of going along to get along, given the political reality.
Yeah, well, you have most of that story right. We weren't actually summoned. That was a meeting and a dinner that was requested by our publisher. And during the dinner, Trump certainly leaned on Bezos, or immediately after the dinner, I should say, he called him and said that, can't you do something to make the Washington Post more fair to me? And what he means by fair is 100% support him. That seems to be Trump's definition of fairness.
Which we can see, and I'm sorry to interrupt just real quick, but with the Wall Street Journal story of the past day, a similar pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wants 100% obsequiousness. That's what he wants. But to your question, there has been more capitulation, and that's been really disturbing. And it's been disturbing. We've seen that in a variety of areas. We've seen it in the legal profession. We've seen it in some other fields as well. Certainly in the world of business, but also in the world of and certainly in the world of the media business. I think that's why Disney agreed to settle with Trump for $16 million, something they would not have done under a previous president. That's why we see why Paramount has settled with Trump for another $16 million. And apparently there's a side deal. Trump seemed to confirm that the other day. He actually did confirm that the other day, that there was a side deal, that if this merger between Paramount and Skydance goes through, that CBS will provide so-called public service announcements for causes that Trump supports. That's worth another $15 to $20 million. And then I've been very public about my concern about the recent behavior of Jeff Bezos, who I feel has been cozying up to Trump. I'm delighted that the newsroom of the Washington Post continues to do its job as it should. Every day there's another revelatory story about what's happening in this administration. And yet I feel that that his actions have been a real disservice to the talented journalists who are working in that newsroom, and frankly, a disservice to democracy overall. So I'm concerned about that. And it's important that those of us who can speak up, that we continue to do so, that we don't all capitulate to this kind of pressure. I was happy to see many law firms stand up to Trump and not bend to his pressure. I'm happy to see Harvard standing up for what it should, which is academic independence. So those are praiseworthy efforts on the part of other institutions. And so while we may be dismayed by the capitulation of certain individuals and certain institutions, we should be heartened by the by how others are standing up to this kind of pressure, totally inappropriate pressure.
Marty Baron is on the air with us, and the number that you can call to support WAMC and your public radio station at this time is 800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262, or of course you can pledge online at WAMC.org.
Marty, it's Sarah. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's a funny thing, isn't it? This moment that we're in, because you, as you are describing, there are instances of capitulation everywhere you look. I think a lot of people out there in the world find this disheartening and tend to feel that there's nowhere to put your energy and nowhere to go to focus, to look at somewhere where change is happening. I don't know about you, I guess recovering journalist and now someone who's connected with this station and you know, trying to do a different kind of job, I feel incredibly galvanized by this moment. This is a moment for great journalism, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, look, it is really unfortunate that the government has, that Trump and the Republican majority in Congress is trying to cut off public media at the knees. Look, there's a time for the public. You know, we call it public media. So it's a time for the public to stand up and support the media that they believe in, support a free and independent press. I mean, look, I mean, ultimately, the rights that we have in this country depend on citizens. They depend on citizens to stand up for them. If people believe in public media, the role that it plays in their communities and in the country, they need to help it out. They need to support it. You know, in the final analysis, we can't survive without the public support. And so the government's not going to do what it has been doing for decades now, but the public needs to make a bigger contribution. It's as simple as that. If we want to have the kind of society that we have grown up with, if we want to sustain democratic principles in this country, look, people don't agree with every story that's done. They don't agree with how every story is done. That's understandable. It's impossible to guarantee 100%, agreement on all these sorts of things. Many of these stories involve controversial subjects. People have their own opinions. But overall, you know, the issue is whether we're going to have a free and independent press in this country. And I think people should, you know, contemplate, what does it mean if we don't have a free and independent press in this country? People should understand that, you know, that if you look at other countries and you see the rise of authoritarianism, one of the first things they do is they try to quash an independent press. And the reason they do that is because they're trying to quash free expression of any type. I mean, I'm talking about the ability of business executives to advocate for the policies that they believe in. I'm talking about the ability of playwrights and filmmakers and authors and musicians to express themselves the way that they feel they should. I'm talking about the right of people to read what they feel they should read and watch what they feel they should watch and listen to what they would like to. Those are the kinds of rights that are really at stake. It's not just an attack on the press. This is an attack on the idea of free expression. And I think it's really important that the public shows that it believes in this kind of expression. I mean, we in the press have no rights, no distinct rights, no rights that are different from any other citizen in this country. And so our free expression rights are the same free expression rights as any ordinary citizen. And so, as I said, this is really an attack on free expression overall, not just an attack on the press. We're just the first step. And so if people want to have if they believe in free expression, they should support a free and independent press.
Well, we thank you so much for your eloquence on this subject and for being with us this morning and for helping us and for being a dear friend. And we thank you so much. Longtime journalist and newspaper editor, Marty Baron. Marty, thank you very much for being here.
Sure. I have to go send a check right now.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Be well. Again, Marty Baron, a longtime journalist and newspaper editor, and Somebody asked me again to repeat the name of the book. It's Collision of Power, which is just a terrific book on his career and especially the last years of that career.
Joe's interview with him about the book online at WAMC.org.
Thank you, producer.
You're welcome.